Lawin Media Network.
Bringing to you the most relevant content across all platforms.
Business, legal, politics, health, lifestyle, and entertainment.
Your source for all the news and updates in the greater Houston community from Texas and all over the world.
Get informed and empowered with Lawin Media Network.
The following program is produced by Lawin Media Network. The views and opinions expressed in this program are solely those of the individuals appearing on the show and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Lawin Media Network, its affiliates, sponsors, or partners. The content provided in this program is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. Lawin Media Network does not guarantee the accuracy, completeness, or timeliness of the information.
Good evening, everybody. You're watching Lawin Media Network live, either through our YouTube channel or our Facebook page. And welcome to tonight's episode of Pink Table Talk. This is our fifth episode, and I'm your host, Dr. Carly D. I'm a doctorally prepared nurse, educator, mentor, advocate, mother, and a domestic violence survivor. So tonight we have a wonderful and fantastic episode for you guys. We're going to be continuing in our discussions on the narcissistic abuse cycle, and we're going to be discussing post-separation abuse with our special guest, Star Davis. Star Davis is a wonderfully accomplished and talented mother, writer. She's been in various literary platforms such as the Kenyon Review, Academy of American Poets Poem a Day, The Rumpus, The Catapult. She has also been recognized as a fellow at the Luminary, Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and Pen America. She has also served as creative nonfiction editor for TriQuarterly, and as a columnist for Mama's Writing at Raising Mothers. She holds an MFA in creative writing from the City College of New York and a BA in journalism and creative writing from the University of Akron. Her personal and political report has earned her positive feedback and placed her reviews in Long Dreads, top five long reads of the week. Her captivating storytelling has covered on podcasts such as What You Didn't Expect in Fertility, Pregnancy, and Birth, Real Stories and Experts and Insights, and also in Truth to Power. As a domestic violence survivor, she has performed and worked with literary communities. She has been nominated for many prestigious literary awards, such as the Pushcart Prize in Poetry and Creative Nonfiction, Best of the Net, and Best American Essays. She is based out of Houston, Texas, and she is a personal friend of mine, and she actively advocates for justice and volunteers with organizations that empower women. So I am extremely excited to have Star with us tonight. So welcome, Star, to the show.
Thank you so much. Always when I hear all these things about myself, I get so tired.
Oh no, you deserve it, and you've earned it, and you've worked hard to accomplish all these wonderful, wonderful things. So, and we're so happy to have you. So thank you so much again for coming to the show tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes. So for our audience members at home and those watching us live, can you tell them a little bit about yourself?
Yes. Like you mentioned in that wonderful intro, I'm mostly known for writing. That's what folks know me as personally, particularly a poet. I've been doing poetry probably all of my adult life. I'm 33 years old. I just had a birthday on July 10th.
So happy birthday.
Thank you. I think that's what makes this conversation so interesting too, because I just remember there being a pressure. And I don't know if it's just being a young Black female, but you didn't want to have a baby young. You wanted to go to college and make your mom proud. And that was my goal. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to make my mom proud. I wanted to make my family proud. And I wanted to do something that no one had done in my family yet. So setting out to be a trailblazer is not for the faint of heart. So I like to say through my gift, I've tried to advocate. And this was before becoming a mother. I think I've always had a heart for advocacy for women and for mothers and for children. I don't want to like disclude children because I think I was always advocating for my inner child, even through poetry, through storytelling, through writing essays. That always felt like the entrance. It felt like the right way to go to be heard and to be taken serious. To me, books are serious. The written word is serious. If something is written down, I think years ago someone told me, if something is written down, that makes it legal. And I thought, wow, that's very powerful. So how powerful is it to legalize myself and my story every day?
And make
something tangible for the next generation. So.
Wow, that's amazing. That's so amazing. I always consider myself a little bit of a poet, but that's back in my elementary days, just a little red is blue, violet blue, whatever. but you know, I'm not
that's a talented
you when it comes to that, you know.
That's poetry, yes, ma'am.
Yes. So you've had such an interesting career so far. And so can you tell us more about your career journey and what's brought you to this point now?
Yes. The other day, someone told me that I was now considered to be a, I'm trying to think of the exact phrasing, but I think they called me a social justice writer. And I've never been called that ever in my writing career. I've only just been Star Davis poet, Star Davis writer, editor, teacher. But to have someone stamp me now as a social justice writer, I think that might be the best thing I've ever been tagged and entitled as, because it makes sense. And I can understand why someone would say that. Motherhood has made me a social justice writer.
Yes. Wow.
Maybe prior to my motherhood journey, maybe I was just a writer, but I think motherhood, and I think any mother who considers themselves to be writing, whether they know this or not, you are writing and advocating for women and for mothers. And you are a part of like a tribe of women who are trying to be heard and trying to have laws and policies and things brought to the regular human perspective. Everyone doesn't know what happens legally to mothers, and everyone doesn't know what happens emotionally or spiritually to mothers. So a writer who's a mom is a very powerful person. So I think where I am now is embracing the fullness of that, embracing the fullness of going, you know what? I am a social justice writer. I am writing to see change for my daughter. And I'm okay with calling myself that right now. So I like to say and motherhood has brought me here. And it's a beautiful thing, honestly, Dr. Carly, because it gives me a new purpose and something new to say.
Yes. And I see we have a special guest here. Hi, Missy.
One and only.
Oh, she's so beautiful. And she's like, I got to see what mommy's up to.
Always.
Yes. Yeah, speaking of mother. Yes. Yes. So, you know, that's the thing about being a mom is that we're always on duty. You know, they don't care what we're doing. They're like, she's like, I don't care. You're filming a live show. I'm here. You know, this is my time.
That's right.
Oh, so that's so good. Yes. And so, so you've worked with some interesting companies and you've won some awards and done a lot of literary pieces. Is there any one particular literary piece that you are most proud of?
Oh, yes. I would have to say it would be my first essay that I wrote after becoming a mom. And that essay went viral and it actually jump started me to where I am today. I see.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And that essay was published was published on the platform Catapult, which was an amazing literary magazine. They're actually no longer publishing or taking literary submissions. So I kind of figure I'm honored to kind of have been within that last wing of writers who got published on that platform. So that essay was called The Funk of Poverty. And
interesting.
It was written while I was in custody court for my child and with my abuser. And I was facing an economic situation between survival and then fighting in court and trying to weigh the odds on what was more important, paying rent or paying an attorney. And that was kind of the basis for that essay.
Wow.
And I'm really proud that I was that vulnerable and brave to kind of put my financial and economic situation out there. But I also threaded a lot of intergenerational trauma into that essay. My family, I was raised on food stamps, government assistance. Even though I have two college degrees and it will seem as if I wouldn't need food stamps, I wouldn't need government assistance. That is exactly where motherhood landed me. And I was kind of toggling with that and wondering, how did I end up in the same place that my mother was?
Yes. Yes. Wow. You know, it's on our second episode, we featured Sarah Galloway, and she mentioned the same thing that you're saying now. She said, you know, she was a professional, you know, she's a nurse. And yet when she left her abuser, also as a single mom with a small child, she too had to go into a shelter, get on public assistance. You know, she too had to struggle, and people were looking at her like, you're too smart for that. You're a professional though. How come you're in this situation? You know, and I think that there's a lot of judgment and stigma there, and a lot of misinformation. A lot of people don't understand that it could be a professional woman who finds themselves in that situation, especially as a single mom. You know, you can find yourself in a situation needing to go to a shelter, needing public assistance, needing, you know, help with your food or paying bills. It's easy for those who have a partner or for those who have a strong family support to not understand that. But there are those of us out there that don't have that support system, and we have had to go through those type of challenges. So when we come back from our break, we're going to talk about Star's experience with leaving her abuser and what happened after that. So stay tuned, and we're going to go on break right now. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Paint Table Talk. The show is produced by Lawin Media Network. We are live every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Central Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. If you can't catch the live recording, you can catch us either on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, Google. We're on 15 different platforms. So before we continue with our guest today, I have some comments from our audience. So the first comment is from Ara Mingya Ungria. Sorry if I'm messing up your name. but she says to us, have a blessed morning. Thank you. You same to you. We also have a comment from Christian Toledo, who says, embracing being a social justice warrior while your child also embraces you. Oh, that's really wonderful. Thank you so much, Christian. And then we have another comment from an Alvin Reyes. And he also says, have a blessed and rainy morning. Yes, we've been getting a lot of rain here in Houston off and on. So thank you all so much for your comments. So Star, last week we featured Coach D. And Coach D, she talked to us about the narcissistic abuse cycle and post-separation abuse. Through meeting you, through our connection with Safe Families for Children, I also know that you survived a very toxic and abusive relationship with someone who is most likely a malignant narcissist. Can you please tell the audience about your experience when you left your abuser?
Yeah, so I was pregnant during the pandemic, the actual start. So I'm talking March 2020, I conceived. So my daughter was born December 2020, right at the end of the year. And I left my abuser when she was about a month and a half. So This was February 2021. And I'll never forget that day because there was a big freeze in Houston.
The infamous freeze.
And I remember thinking, why is everyone's car smashing into each other? Like, what's the big deal? Because I'm from Ohio and I lived in New York, so I'm used to seeing folks know how to drive snow. I had a moment where I understood this is either God intervening because I had no other way to treat it. Or this is the breaking point where something's going to happen. And both things were happening at the same time. It was my breaking point in that relationship where I was understanding the baby wasn't going to stop the abuse. Her birth was not going to protect me. The innocence of having a newborn child in the house was not going to protect me. And it wasn't protecting me. I was actually now receiving it worse than I was during my pregnancy. And I think it was because I was regaining myself.
Yes, that part.
I was mobile. I'm walking around. I don't need so much help and so much assistance. I'm returning to work. I had also just won a very large fellowship, Pen America. Things were happening for me. So I'm thinking of Rihanna doing that halftime Super Bowl show. And someone on TikTok posted about the power of a pregnant woman, kind of having that glory moment where because she's having a baby, she can have it all. And I think that was happening to me unknowingly. And I was also trying to figure out what was going on. But I was really blessed. And it was triggering that person. It was making the abuse worse.
Wow.
So when I left, it was in the middle of that storm. And, you know, it was between me and my things and my child. And I chose my child that day, and I left with the clothes on our backs. I left with finished apartment and all of my possessions because he came in with nothing. So the apartment furnishings down to everything on the wall and the forks and the drawers were mine. But I left everything behind, and I just took that diaper bag, my baby, and my purse with just personal documents, and I left.
Yeah.
And it was a very bold and scary move, but it was the best move I've ever made in my life. And his response to that was, of course, to immediately try to reach out. He called the police, and he actually reported that we were both missing. And my youngest sister actually received a call from the police in the middle of the night, and they asked if she knew where we were, and she says, yeah, they're fine. But I knew it was the start of him kind of knowing the system better than I did, because what doing and what I was unaware he was doing was he was starting a paper trail. Starting a paper trail. He was starting to draft this iconic story that he would get to present in front of the court that would, of course, make him the victim and me the villain. And I had no idea that is what was happening.
Wow. That's something, you know. Yes. And, you know, Coach D said that these people are very deceiving, but they're smart. And she said they know and they're paying attention. And that we often underestimate just how smart they are, because they'll play dumb. They'll play like, you know, they don't know anything that's going on, but they know systems and they know how to play the systems well.
So, yes. And I was at a disadvantage because not only did I just have a baby, but I was experiencing postpartum depression, and I was in fear. And fear doesn't just leave you when you had a child. Fear was all over me. I put it on every day. And I feel bad to admit this, but there were women and men in my life who were giving me excuses and also encouraging me to embrace that fear. There were women in my life who were telling me, oh, we've all had a crazy baby daddy. We've all been there. It's all right. And it was just like, oh, okay. So now I'm kind of getting a pass to walk through life fearful and be okay with it, because I've had 10 other women tell me, oh, we've all been there. It's all right.
Yes. It's become normalized.
Yes. Normalized. Yeah.
And it's unhealthy.
Very, very. And I think we spend too much time as women justifying emotions that are just not going to serve us in the long run. So it took me 2 years for an attorney to finally tell me the number one fault of my domestic violence clients is that they let fear stay in the driver's seat.
And
they learn to play defense instead of offense. It's so true. Fear was my driver. I allowed it to be my driver. And it took a while to break free from that mentality.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you also had a reason to be in fear. You know, this is a highly malignant person that you were dealing with. Can you tell us about what happened once you were gone, what happened legally?
So once I got myself established in another state, I was served with a petition from Texas for custody. And this was around 4 to 5 months after I had moved. So I was actually unaware that you can be served called a substitute service. So it wasn't that he found me in another state. He actually found me through another relative and had me served at a relative's house.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. I never knew that.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad I can educate people today because, you know, if that person feels knowledgeable that that relative sees you on a daily basis, they can serve you at a relative's home. And believe it or not, but the state of Texas recognized taping papers to my sister's door as me being served. And they said, yes, you were served, called substitute service. And I couldn't believe it.
I never knew that either.
It was really hard to, in the midst of my mothering, go, oh, I need to learn the legal system. I need to learn the law.
Yes. You know, it's true, though. And even through the past few years, six years that I've been dealing with this, I realized that we do have to learn about the laws when it comes to children in custody. You know, I think we are at a disadvantage when we are knowledgeable. We don't have enough knowledge about the system. Because, you know, even today, just learning about the substitute service, I didn't know that either. But I think that when we find ourselves in these situations dealing with these malignant types and we have children by them, we do, unfortunately, like your lawyer said, we have to get on the offense. And it's time to start, you know, doing our research, time to start learning and looking up the laws and doing our reading. And there are law libraries people can go to. And unfortunately, you have to just sit there and start to learn and learn the laws in your state.
Especially. And that was a huge issue for my case. I'm in another state. So I'm in the state of Ohio. Texas is serving me. I didn't know that was possible, but it was possible because, again, I am not a resident until I'm 6 months verified as a resident of another state. So because we're between the 5th month mark, I'm still servable in another state through, you know, through the state of Texas. Texas did not ever identify my residency as an Ohioan. Never identified my child as an Ohioan. She was a Texan. She was born in Texas. She was taken by, these are the legal terms. She was taken from the state of Texas and she was to return to the state of Texas. And I didn't know that those things were law. I didn't know that an Ohio attorney was not going to be able to touch my case. So here I am in another state, but no legal action can be taken on my part.
Oh my goodness. Wow. We're gonna go on another break, but when we come back, I want to hear more about your experience with dealing with this interstate custody situation. So stay tuned, everybody, and we'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Pink Table Talk. Tonight we have Star Davis here telling us about her journey through the legal system, custody, and motherhood. So Star, before we took a break, you were telling us how you had been served in Ohio with papers from Texas, and that even though you had a lawyer in Ohio, they could not do anything here in the state of Texas. I think it's because of like jurisdiction,
So Texas took that jurisdiction. So once Texas said, hey, this is our case, we're going to take it. We believe it's a Texas issue. Ohio was hands off. No legal action could be taken in the state of Ohio, regardless of the rental lease we're on, the job I had, the driver's license I got, the car, her being enrolled in daycare. None of that mattered. So, about 8 months after leaving my abuser, I was forced by law, by the family court system, after trial, to return to the state of Texas in 30 days. My daughter was 9 months. She was just learning how to walk. And we had also both been diagnosed with COVID-19.
Oh, wow.
But we're ordered by a judge to return to the state of Texas in 30 days. And, you know, it was a really hard time for me to process that I'm a new mom. But by law, someone convicting me of already doing something wrong. So if I hadn't already had mom guilt, I definitely hadn't been. Because action just makes you feel like you're guilty of something. And even when you know you're not wrong. And in my heart, I knew I'm not wrong for leaving an abusive person. Right. I'm not wrong for picking up and taking my child to safety. I can't be wrong for these things. So in my heart, I knew I wasn't wrong, but there's an entity that felt way bigger than me that said, you're wrong.
Wow. Were they aware that he was abusive towards you?
It came down to the lack of police reporting, and it came down to my lack of evidence to prove that he had been abusive. I had some text messages. I had a photograph of a bruise he left on my arm during my pregnancy, and I had about 10 witness statements, and I thought maybe this would be enough, but it turns out none of it was enough to actually stick. And a lawyer also told me domestic violence is really hard to prove.
Yes. Unfortunately, that's something that I too have learned, is that without like enough police reports, unfortunately, the courts don't really take domestic violence seriously. And the bad thing is many victims don't report the abuse. You know, there's many times, many incidents where they're scared to call the police, or because they know the abuse will get worse. First of all, if they call the police and report the abuser, also some of them don't have anywhere else to go. They don't want to go to shelter out of fear and shame. So there is a lack of police evidence when it comes to proving domestic violence. So we have a comment in the audience. I'm going to go to that. This is from Brian Wong. He says, what are the most common challenges individuals face when navigating legal abuse after separation? And what resources in Houston or in Harris County in general are available to support them? Well, that's a really great question, Brian. I'll have Star tackle this question for us.
Yeah, legal abuse is, I think, something that hasn't been discovered fully yet. I don't think.
Yes.
I don't think there's been a separation or an actual clause where someone's going, oh, this person's being legally abused right now. I think that that's really hard to prove as well. But what I say, what my common challenge was, at least, was not playing the victim role. That other person is playing victim. So two people who want to play victim, it makes you both look a little irresponsible, and it makes you both look like you're not, you don't truly care for the child.
Yes.
So I had to come out of the mindset that I am the battered mother. I am the mother that the judge should have sympathy for. Like, I had to kind of rise to a different occasion of self. And so, let me show the judge I am just a good mother, and that my focus is on the child, and that person's focus is on being a victim. That's not my focus. So that is a challenge. Yes, you're the victim. Yes, you are under legal abuse, but you kind of can't portray yourself that way. You have to be the bigger person. And I think the resources, at least that helped me in Houston, I think the center is called Aveda. I reached out to them. Yeah, Aveda was a huge help for me. They give free legal advice. These are people who you can just call and speak to a legal aid, and they'll kind of, in nuts and bolts, kind of give you the confidence you need to fight the case pro se, if that is something you're interested in. Or you can also apply to have one of their legal attorneys take on your case. Of course, that's a huge wait list, and there has to be some eligibility requirements, but as far as their legal advice, it was outstanding. I had an amazing person tell me, "Mom, you're the victim, but I don't want you to walk into that court the victim." And she prepped me and made me feel strong. And that was the best advice I got. There are really great resources here in Texas that do try to uplift domestic violence victims to help them beat these cases against their abusers. So please look into Aveda and any other resources for domestic violence victims in Houston.
Wow. Thank you for that, Star. That was a great question, Brian. Thank you. So, Star, I know the last part of your story, you said that you had to return to Texas. You were in Ohio, but you were settled. You know, you had a life there. And your daughter had her daycare set up. So what was that journey like coming back to Texas?
I was in deep fear. Again, fear was always in the driver's seat. So fear drove me back. Fear drove me away, and it pulled me right back up. I was in deep fear because the courts would not give me a protection order.
Wow.
Oh, there was just no one believed me. No one believed me. My story didn't check out in court. If it can't be proven, it didn't happen. So it didn't happen. So I had to come back to Texas aware that I was going to be unprotected, but that was going to be my moment to also then get a police report. So it was a guinea pig moment that I feel, forgive me, but I just have to boldly state this. I truly believe that the family court system, until something is actually proven, I think they put domestic violence victims back in the access of their abusers to almost test it out themselves to see, is this person really abusive towards you, the child? If so, let's give an order. Let's give you both access. Let's not give anyone any boundaries or protective orders. And let's see what happens. And that is exactly what happened. He had full access to my daughter. He had full access to my address. He had full access to my tax documents, my pay stubs. He knew where I worked. He knew everything about me. And that is when threats came in. That is when the fear of my life and his anger and his taunting began and his terrorizing began. And ultimately that drove me back out of Texas the same way it did initially.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Yes.
But I had police reports. I had police reports, right? So now I came down, I collected my police reports and I'm going to go back home where I'm safe. That kind of also did not help my case. It made me look defiant.
To the court.
Yes, to the court. And I made a huge mistake saying to myself, I'm back in danger and I have to leave again. Instead of recognizing I'm now in his playing field and I can and tactfully fight this and show the court exactly what's going on. I can correct the story, but I actually continue to manifest his result by, again, letting fear stay in that driver's seat.
Wow. We're going to take another break, but when we come back from the break, we're going to continue with this amazing story with Star Davis. So stay tuned, everybody.
In a world cluttered with information, where truth is power, Law & Weekly News stands apart.
We delve deeper, uncover facts, and bring stories to light. From political showdowns and economic triumphs to the pulse of the street and the heart of the community,
we capture the moments that define us, stories that challenge, inspire, and transform.
Tune in live Sundays 8 a.m. Central Standard Time and Sundays 6 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Welcome back, everybody, to Pink Table Talk. And we're here again with Star Davis. So we're going to have her continue her story. So last year when I met you, Star, you were not with Heavenlyn, your daughter.
No.
So can you tell us about you?
Yeah. A big part of my story, and I'm glad, thank you for letting me kind of build the framework. Eventually, letting fear remain in the driver's seat resulted in me truly becoming the villain in my case. I was not able to prove myself to be a good mother. I just looked truly defiant before the court's eyes here in Texas. And so full custody was granted to my abuser. And my child, 2022, was taken by Children's Services. And I was arrested under a charge that is called interference with child custody. And that's just a fancy charge for meaning I am interfering with what a court has ordered over a child's life. So my child was ordered to reside with her father in Harris County, and she was not to reside with me as her primary. And so she was forcibly then taken, and I was arrested to make sure that, you know, she got to where the state believed she belonged. So yes, Carly, when we met, I was about very fresh, like a week into losing my child. And you know, I was lost and deeply depressed and sad and crushed. And you know, thank you for being such a lighthouse for me at that time, because I just remember I didn't know what else to do other than surround myself with women who knew what I was going through, or could sympathize and could help lift me back up, because I knew that I was going to get my child back somehow, some way, just a feeling, you know.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm grateful for that feeling, because I think it would have been easier for me to feel so defeated. But I don't know if it's because I had been raising my daughter on my own for 2 years, and I knew that her world and my world was so in sync. There was no true separation of mother and daughter at that point. Our spirits were too intertwined. We had too many memories. We had identified too much with one another to where I just believed in the power of our connection was just going to lead us right back to one another. And it took 11 months, Dr. Carly, but here we are.
Yes. Yes, clearly we see her. She's popping in and out of the broadcast. So I truly believe that y'all have that in sync connection.
We do. That is my mini me. So yes.
And I applaud your courage and your strength and your resilience. Going through 11 months without your daughter, knowing she was with your abuser, how did you cope during that time?
I was reading a book on parenting with a narcissist. It was one of those free Kindle reads. I had to kind of go back to the way I learn best, and it is through the written word. So again, to me, if something is written down, it makes it legal, it makes it real. So I want to read real stories from real women who have had to live through these experiences. And it was a passage in that book where the writer stops and goes, I'm going to break and pause here to say, if you are blaming yourself for picking an abuser as a parent for your child, I want to say directly to you, you are the best thing for your child.
Yes.
You are their emotionally stable parent. You are their spiritual connection. You are the balance. You have not failed them. And I just wept at that passage. I needed to hear that, because I had to consistently tell myself, she's going to make it through this. She's going to make it through. That's my daughter. She has emotional stability. She has spiritual discernment. She's wise. She's got this. If I got it, she's got it. And I spiritually mothered her all the way home. And that's how I kind of like to think about it. I spiritually warred for her until she was back in my arms again. And
that
scripture, pray without ceasing, is such a real thing. I had to remember to pray and to not let up and to not grow weary in it. It felt like he was winning, but I had to remember that parenting isn't about winners. I'm going to do the best I can, but there's no book on this. And that was my mom's quote. She used to go, there's no book on this. And now I know there truly is no book on this. I've looked and I've read some things and there's no book on this. That's correct.
It's so true. And we often feel like we're failing, but I love that quote you said, you know, that we are the best thing for our child. And I believe that and I resonate with that. And wow, that's really powerful. For those out there who are in this situation, or for those in abusive situations who may be thinking about leaving their abuser, what are some words of advice, support, or encouragement that you can offer to them out there?
Oh, wow. You know, I guess my first advice would be make the hard decision now to just choose yourself and your child's safety. I think the big thing I wrestled with for a long time, and when I say long time, I mean 9 months while I was actually growing my child, is I thought I would be doing her a disservice by parting ways with the person who was supposed to also raise her. And I thought it would have been a selfish move to go, you know what? No, I'm going to do this by myself. I'm not going to do this. But it is not selfish to be safe. It is not selfish to life. It is not selfish to make sure your child is alive and that you're both healthy. So make that hard decision now and don't wait and go, well, let me at least make sure they know this person. Let me make sure this person gets a chance. No, if that person has already shown you who they are, because I think you parent each other in a relationship. So if they're not kind to you already in a relationship and they're showing you already that they cannot pass down kindness towards another, it's time to go. And so, yes, that would be my first advice. And my second would be just to trust the process. I've left everything behind, but I trusted that I would get things back. I've lost great things. I've lost my child, but I trusted that I would go through the process and get her back. Yes. So trust the process. It's hard, but trust the process. And as hard as it is for me to even say this, I will say trust the legal process too. And trust the legal process in a way that just will benefit you. If that means finding the right attorney, and I've went through 5 attorneys, Dr. Carly. I went through about 5 because I'm like, I need the right person to help me. Trust the legal process, or trust someone who knows the legal process to help you. They do say that it is important to have a lawyer when you're in family court, and I would have to agree. Yes. It helps to have advocacy. It helps to have someone rooting you on and someone there who knows the laws better than we do. I did not know the law. I needed someone who knew it better than I did, of course. And I've had some great attorneys. I truly have. I just think the process has been long, but trust the process.
Oh, thank you so much, Star, for your inspirational and just heartwarming and just overall magnificent story. Tell us about MOVE.
Yes, Quickly Move is an organization that I am launching. I hope to launch this in 2025. I have an amazing partner right now, and we want to help women escape. Our goal is to buy a moving truck and to by nonprofit, by donations and grant funding. We want to move mothers and their children to safety for free. We want to help women break out of these cycles. And a lot of women stay with abusers because of finances. I get it. I've gone through my own economic struggles, but if we can be a lighthouse in Houston to women who are truly fighting for their lives and their children's safety and get them to a shelter, back to a relative, or just to a new home where this person cannot locate them, that is what we want to do. We're ready to step in, and I'm actually ready to pay it forward because, Dr. Carly, I've been that woman who's needed someone to move me. I've needed someone to help me. I've been told by a judge to move to another state in less than 30 days, and I had no one to help me. So I want to be that catalyst, that pillar, that safe house that I didn't have, you know, in a crisis situation where I was fighting an interstate custody battle. And I want to help women who've been in that same situation or are in that same situation. So our email is there on the screen. And this is a fantastic logo that a friend of mine made for me. And we just can't wait to get this launched.
Beautiful. Oh, thank you so much, Star. This is really beautiful. Your amazing journey. From victim to survivor to thriver. And now you're paying it forward to other mothers out there with your fiance who has some comments here. He says, my beautiful wife, hello. It's already, it got you married. And then he says, look at your smile. I'm so happy you're doing this, and I appreciate you for having her on your podcast. Of course, we've been talking about this for months.
We have, yes.
This is a woman that's going to change the world. And yes, I truly, and everything that you're doing now is definitely going to change the world, if not just for the mothers in your situation, but hopefully it will encourage maybe the lawyers and the judges in the legal system, in family court, to be able to see things through the victim's eyes, the true victim's eyes. So thank you all for joining us tonight. Pink Table Talk, it's every Wednesday on Law and Media Network Live, either through our YouTube or Facebook channels, and also on our podcast, Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon. And thank you so much again, everybody. And on Wednesdays, we talk pink. Have a good night, everybody.